Maybe they were getting married. She in her white dress, he in his black suit and bow tie. They were looking deep into each other's eyes. If you want to save her, all you have to do is go with the uncle with the big Mishas. He'll ask you a question, one question. All you have to do is say yes. Then we can all go home. It's so easy. It's a small price to pay. Baby Kuchma followed Esther's gaze. It was all she could do to prevent herself from taking the paperweight and flinging it out of the window. Her heart was hammering. So, she said with a bright, brittle smile, the strain beginning to tell in her voice, what shall I tell the inspector uncle? What have we decided? Do you want to save Ammu? Or shall we send her to jail? As though she was offering them a choice of two treats. Fishing or bathing the pigs? Bathing the pigs or fishing? The twins looked up at her. Not together, but almost, two frightened voices whispered, save Ammu. In the years to come, they would replay this scene in their heads, as children, as teenagers, as adults. Had they been deceived into doing what they did? Had they been tricked into condemnation? In a way, yes. But it wasn't as simple as that. They both knew that they had been given a choice, and how quick they had been in the choosing. They hadn't given it more than a second of thought before they looked up and said, not together but almost, save Ammu, save us, save our mother. Baby Kuchma beamed. Relief worked like a laxative. She needed to go to the bathroom, urgently. She opened the door and asked for the inspector. They're good little children, she told him when he came. They'll go with you. No need for both. One will serve the purpose, Inspector Thomas Matthew said. Anyone, Morn, Morl, who wants to come with me? Esther, Baby Kuchma chose, knowing him to be the more practical of the two, the more tractable, the more far-sighted, the more responsible. You go. Good boy. Little man. He lived in a caravan. Dumb, dumb. Esther went. Ambassador E. Pelvis, with saucer eyes and a spoiled puff. A short ambassador flanked by tall policemen on a terrible mission deep into the bowels of the Khartoum police station, their footsteps echoing on the flagstone floor. Rahel remained behind in the inspector's office and listened to the rude sounds of Baby Kuchma's relief dribbling down the sides of the inspector's pot in his attached toilet. The flush doesn't work, she said when she came out. It's so annoying. Embarrassed that the inspector would see the color and consistency of her stool. The lockup was pitch dark. Esther could see nothing, but he could hear the sound of rasping, labored breathing. The smell of shit made him retch. Someone switched on the light. Bright. Blinding. Velitha appeared on the scummy, slippery floor. A mangled genie invoked by a modern lamp. He was naked. His soiled munda had come undone. Blood spilled from his skull like a secret. His face was swollen, and his head looked like a pumpkin, too large and heavy for the slender stem it grew from. A pumpkin with a monstrous upside-down smile. Police boots stepped back from the rim of a pool of urine spreading from him, the bright, bare electric bulb reflected in it. Dead fish floated up in Esther. One of the policemen prodded Velitha with his foot. There was no response. Inspector Thomas Matthew squatted on his haunches and raked his jeep key across the sole of Velitha's foot. Swollen eyes opened, wandered, then focused through a film of blood on a beloved child. Esther imagined that something in him smiled. Not his mouth, but some other unhurt part of him. His elbow, perhaps. Or shoulder. The inspector asked his question. Esther's mouth said yes. Childhood tiptoed out. Silence slid in like a bolt. Someone switched off the light, and Velitha disappeared. On their way back in the police jeep, Babykuchma stopped at Reliable Medicos for some calm pills. She gave them two each. By the time they reached Chungam Bridge, their eyes were beginning to close. Esther whispered something into Rahel's ear. "You were right. It wasn't him. It was Urumban." "Thank God," Rahel whispered back. "Where do you think he is?" "Escaped to Africa." They were handed over to their mother, fast asleep, floating on this fiction. Until the next morning, when Amu shook it out of them. But by then it was too late. Inspector Thomas Matthew, a man of experience in these matters, was right. Velitha didn't live through the night. Half an hour past midnight, death came for him. And for the little family curled up and asleep on a blue cross-stitch counterpane, what came for them? Not death. Just the end of living. After Sophie Moll's funeral, when Ammu took them back to the police station and the inspector chose his mangoes, tap, tap, the body had already been removed. Dumped in the Temmadikuri, the pauper's pit, where the police routinely dump their dead. When Babykuchma heard about Ammu's visit to the police station, she was terrified. Everything that she, Babykuchma, had done had been premised on one assumption. She had gambled on the fact that Ammu, whatever else she did, however angry she was, would never publicly admit to her relationship with Velitha. Because, according to Babykuchma, that would amount to destroying herself and her children, forever. But Babykuchma hadn't taken into account the unsafe edge in Ammu, the unmixable mix, the infinite tenderness of motherhood, the reckless rage of a suicide bomber. Amu's reaction stunned her. The ground fell away from under her feet. She knew she had an ally in Inspector Thomas Matthew, but how long would that last? What if he was transferred and the case reopened? It was possible, considering the shouting, sloganeering crowd of party workers that Comrade K.N.M. Pillay had managed to assemble outside the gate, that prevented the laborers from coming to work and left vast quantities of mangoes, bananas, pineapple, garlic, and ginger rotting slowly on the premises of Paradise Pickles. Babykuchma knew she had to get Ammu out of Imanam as soon as possible. She managed that by doing what she was best at, irrigating her fields, nourishing her crops with other people's passions. She gnawed like a rat into the godown of Chako's grief. Within its walls, she planted an easy, accessible target for his insane anger. It wasn't hard for her to portray Ammu as the person actually responsible for Sophie Moll's death. Ammu and her two-egg twins. Chako breaking down doors was only the sad bull thrashing at the end of Baby Kuchma's leash. It was her idea that Ammu be made to pack her bags and leave, that Esther be returned. Chapter 20. The Madras Mail. And so, at the Cochin Harbour terminus, Esther alone at the barred train window. Ambassador E. Pelvis, a millstone with a puff, and a green-wavy, thick-watery, lumpy, seaweedy, floaty, bottomless, bottomful feeling. His trunk with his name on it was under his seat, his tiffin box with tomato sandwiches and his eagle flask with an eagle was on the little folding table in front of him. Next to him, an eating lady in a green and purple kanjivaram sari and diamonds clustered like shining bees on each nostril offered him yellow laddus in a box. Esther shook his head. She smiled and coaxed. Her kind eyes disappeared into slits behind her glasses. She made kissing sounds with her mouth. "Try one. Very sweet," she said in Tamil. "Rombo madaram." "Sweet," her oldest daughter, who was about Esther's age, said in English. Esther shook his head again. The lady ruffled his hair and spoiled his puff. Her family, husband and three children, was already eating. Big round yellow laddu crumbs on the seat. Train rumbles under their feet. The blue nightlight not yet on. The eating lady's small son switched it on. The eating lady switched it off. She explained to the child that it was a sleeping light, not an awake light. Every first-class train thing was green. The seats green, the berths green, the floor green, the chains green. Dark green, light green. To stop train, pull chain, it said, in green. Ot pots niart lup niach, Esther thought, in green. Through the window bars, Amu held his hand. Keep your ticket carefully, Amu's mouth said. Amu's trying not to cry mouth. They'll come and check. Esther nodded down at Amu's face, tilted up to the train window. At Rahel, small and smudged with station dirt. All three of them bonded by the certain, separate knowledge that they had loved a man to death. That wasn't in the papers. It took the twins years to understand Amu's part in what had happened. At Sophie Moll's funeral and in the days before Esther was returned, they saw her swollen eyes, and with the self-centeredness of children, held themselves wholly culpable for her grief. Eat the sandwiches before they get soggy, Amu said, and don't forget to write. She scanned the fingernails of the little hand she held and slid a black sickle of dirt from under the thumbnail. And look after my sweetheart for me, until I come and get him. When, Amu? When will you come for him? Soon. But when? When exactly? Soon, sweetheart. As soon as I can. Month after next, Amu? Deliberately making it a long time away so that Amu would say, before that, Esther, be practical. What about your studies? As soon as I get a job. As soon as I can go away from here and get a job, Amu said. But that will be never. A wave of panic, a bottomless, bottomful feeling. The eating lady eavesdropped indulgently. See how nicely he speaks English, she said to her children in Tamil. But that will be never, her oldest daughter said combatively. N-E-V-E-R, never. By never, Esther had only meant that it would be too far away. That it wouldn't be now, wouldn't be soon. By never, he hadn't meant not ever. But that's how the words came out. But that will be never. For never, they just took the O and T out of not ever. They? The government. Where people were sent to jolly well behave. And that's how it had all turned out. Never. Not ever. It was his fault that the faraway man in Amu's chest stopped shouting. His fault that she died alone in the lodge, with no one to lie at the back of her and talk to her. Because he was the one that had said it. But Amu, that will be never. Don't be silly, Esther. It'll be soon, Amu's mouth said. I'll be a teacher, I'll start a school, and you and Rahel will be in it. And we'll be able to afford it because it will be ours, Esther said, with his enduring pragmatism, his eye on the main chance. Free bus rides, free funerals, free education, little man. He lived in a caravan, dum-dum. We'll have our own house, Amu said. A little house, Rahel said. And in our school we'll have classrooms and blackboards, Esther said. And chalk. And real teachers teaching. And proper punishments, Rahel said. This was the stuff their dreams were made of. On the day that Esther was returned. Chalk. Blackboards. Proper punishments. They didn't ask to be let off lightly, They only asked for punishments that fitted their crimes. Not ones that came like cupboards with built-in bedrooms. Not ones you spent your whole life in, wandering through its maze of shelves. Without warning, the train began to move, very slowly. Esther's pupils dilated. His nails dug into Amu's hand as she walked along the platform, her walk turning into a run as the Madras mail picked up speed. God bless my baby, my sweetheart. I'll come for you soon. Amu, Esther said as she disengaged her hand, prising loose small finger after finger. Amu, feeling vomity. Esther's voice lifted into a wail. Little Elvis the pelvis, with a spoiled, special outing puff, and beige and pointy shoes. He left his voice behind. On the station platform, Rahel doubled over and screamed and screamed. The train pulled out. The light pulled in. 23 years later, Rahel, dark woman in a yellow t-shirt, turns to Esther in the dark. Esther papi chachin kutta pen pitamon, she says. She whispers. She moves her mouth. Their beautiful mother's mouth. Esther, sitting very straight, waiting to be arrested, takes his fingers to it. To touch the words it makes. To keep the whisper. His fingers follow the shape of it. The touch of teeth. His hand is held and kissed, pressed against the coldness of a cheek, wet with shattered rain. Then she sat up and put her arms around him, drew him down beside her. They lay like that for a long time, awake in the dark. Quietness and emptiness. Not old, not young, but a viable, dieable age. They were strangers who had met in a chance encounter. They had known each other before life began. There is very little that anyone could say to clarify what happened next. Nothing that, in Mamachi's book, would separate sex from love, or needs from feelings. Except, perhaps, that no watcher watched through Rahel's eyes. No one stared out of a window at the sea, or a boat in the river, or a passerby in the mist in a hat. Except perhaps that it was a little cold, a little wet, but very quiet, the air. But what was there to say? Only that there were tears. Only that quietness and emptiness fitted together like stacked spoons. Only that there was a snuffling in the hollows at the base of a lovely throat. Only that a hard, honey-colored shoulder had a semicircle of teeth marks on it. Only that they held each other close, long after it was over. Only that what they shared that night was not happiness, but hideous grief. Only that once again they broke the love laws that lay down who should be loved, and how much. On the roof of the abandoned factory, the lonely drummer drummed. A gauze door slammed. A mouse rushed across the factory floor. Cobwebs sealed old pickle vats. Empty, all but one, in which a small heap of congealed white dust lay. Bone dust, from a bar now. Long dead, pickled owl. In answer to Sophie Mall's question, Chaco, where do old birds go to die? Why don't dead ones fall like stones from the sky? Asked on the evening of the day she arrived. She was standing on the edge of Baby Kutchma's ornamental pond, looking up at the kites wheeling in the sky. Sophie Moore, hatted, bell-bottomed, and loved from the beginning. Margaret Kutchma, because she knew that when you travel to the heart of darkness, B, anything can happen to anyone, called her in to have her regimen of pills. Filaria, malaria, diarrhea. She had no prophylaxis, unfortunately, for death by drowning. Then it was time for dinner.
Supper, silly,
Sophie Moll said when Esther was sent to call her. At supper, silly, the children sat at a separate smaller table. Sophie Moll, with her back to the grown-ups, made gruesome faces at the food. Every mouthful she ate was displayed to her admiring younger cousins, half-chewed, mulched, lying on her tongue like fresh vomit. When Rahel did the same, Amu saw her and took her to bed. Amu tucked her naughty daughter in and switched off the light. Her goodnight kiss left no spit on Rahel's cheek, and Rahel could tell that she wasn't really angry.
You're not angry, Amu, in a happy whisper. A little more her mother loved her.
No. Amu kissed her again. Good night, sweetheart. God bless.
Good night, Amu. Send Esther soon.
And as Amu walked away, she heard her daughter whisper,
Amu!
What is it?
We be of one blood, thou and I.
Amu leaned against the bedroom door in the dark, reluctant to return to the dinner table, where the conversation circled like a moth around the white child and her mother, as though they were the only source of light. Amu felt that she would die, wither and die, if she heard another word, if she had to endure another minute of Chako's proud tennis trophy smile, or the undercurrent of sexual jealousy that emanated from Mamachi, or Baby Kuchma's conversation that was designed to exclude Amu and her children, to inform them of their place in the scheme of things. As she leaned against the door in the darkness, she felt her dream, her afternoon mare, move inside her like a rib of water rising from the ocean gathering into a wave. The cheerful one-armed man, with salty skin and a shoulder that ended abruptly like a cliff, emerged from the shadows of the jagged beach and walked towards her.
Who was he? Who could he have been?
The god of loss, the god of small things, the god of goosebumps and sudden smiles. He could do only one thing at a time. If he touched her, he couldn't talk to her. If he loved her, he couldn't leave. If he spoke, he couldn't listen. If he fought, he couldn't win. Amu longed for him, ached for him with the whole of her biology. She returned to the dinner table. Chapter 21. The Cost of Living. When the old house had closed its bleary eyes and settled into sleep, Amu, wearing one of Chako's old shirts over a long white petticoat, walked out onto the front veranda. She paced up and down for a while, restless, feral. Then she sat on the wicker chair below the moldy, button-eyed bison head, and the portraits of the Little Blessed One and Eliutiamachi that hung on either side of it. Her twins were sleeping the way they did when they were exhausted, with their eyes half open, two small monsters. They got that from their father. Amu switched on her tangerine transistor. A man's voice crackled through it, an English song she hadn't heard before. She sat there in the dark, a lonely, lambent woman looking out at her embittered aunt's ornamental garden, listening to a tangerine, to a voice from far away, wafting through the night, sailing over lakes and rivers, over dense heads of trees, past the yellow church, past the school, bumping up the dirt road, up the steps of the veranda, to her. Barely listening to the music, she watched the frenzy of insects flitting around the light, vying to kill themselves. The words of the song exploded in her head. There's no time to lose, I heard her say. Cash your dreams before they slip away. Dying all the time. Lose your dreams and you will lose your mind. Amu drew her knees up and hugged them. She couldn't believe it. The cheap coincidence of those words. She stared fiercely out at the garden,
Ausa, the bar now, flew past on a silent nocturnal patrol. The fleshy anthurians gleamed like gunmetal. She remained sitting for a while, long after the song had ended. Then suddenly she rose from her chair and walked out of her world like a witch. To a better, happier place. She moved quickly through the darkness, like an insect following a chemical trail. She knew the path to the river as well as her children did, and could have found her way there blindfolded. She didn't know what it was that made her hurry through the undergrowth, that turned her walk into a run, that made her arrive on the banks of the Meenachil breathless, sobbing, as though she was late for something, as though her life depended on getting there in time, as though she knew he would be there, waiting, as though he knew she would come. He did. No. That knowledge had slid into him that afternoon, cleanly, like the sharp edge of a knife, when history had slipped up, while he had held her little daughter in his arms, when her eyes had told him he was not the only giver of gifts, that she had gifts to give him too, that in return for his boats, his boxes, his small windmills, she would trade her deep dimples when she smiled, her smooth brown skin, her shining shoulders, her eyes that were always somewhere else. He wasn't there. Amu sat on the stone steps that led to the water. She buried her head in her arms, feeling foolish for having been so sure, so certain. Farther downstream in the middle of the river, Velitha floated on his back, looking up at the stars. His paralyzed brother and his one-eyed father had eaten the dinner he had cooked them and were asleep, so he was free to lie in the river and drift slowly with the current. A log, a serene crocodile. Coconut trees bent into the river and watched him float by. Yellow bamboo wept. Small fish took coquettish liberties with him, pecked him. He flipped over and began to swim, upstream, against the current. He turned towards the bank for one last look, treading water, feeling foolish for having been so sure, so certain. When he saw her, the detonation almost drowned him. It took all his strength to stay afloat. He trod water, standing in the middle of a dark river. She didn't see the knob of his head bobbing over the dark river. He could have been anything, a floating coconut. In any case, she wasn't looking. Her head was buried in her arms. He watched her. He took his time. Had he known that he was about to enter a tunnel whose only egress was his own annihilation, would he have turned away? Perhaps. Perhaps not. Who can tell? He began to swim towards her, quietly, cutting through the water with no fuss. He had almost reached the bank when she looked up and saw him. His feet touched the muddy riverbed. As he rose from the dark river and walked up the stone steps, she saw that the world they stood in was his, that he belonged to it, that it belonged to him, the water, the mud, the trees, the fish, the stars. He moved so easily through it. As she watched him, she understood the quality of his beauty, how his labor had shaped him, how the wood he fashioned had fashioned him. Each plank he planed, each nail he drove, each thing he made had molded him, had left its stamp on him, had given him his strength, his supple grace. He wore a thin white cloth around his loins, looped between his dark legs. He shook the water from his hair. She could see his smile in the dark, his white, sudden smile that he had carried with him from boyhood into manhood, his only luggage. They looked at each other. They weren't thinking anymore. The time for that had come and gone. Smashed smiles lay ahead of them. But that would be later. Later. He stood before her with the river dripping from him. She stayed sitting on the steps, watching him, her face pale in the moonlight. A sudden chill crept over him, his heart hammered. It was all a terrible mistake. He had misunderstood her. The whole thing was a figment of his imagination. This was a trap. There were people in the bushes watching. She was the delectable bait. How could it be otherwise? They had seen him in the march. He tried to make his voice casual, normal. It came out in a croak. Amukutti, what is it? She went to him and laid the length of her body against his. He just stood there. He didn't touch her. He was shivering. Partly with cold. Partly terror. Partly aching desire. Despite his fear, his body was prepared to take the bait. It wanted her, urgently. His wetness wet her. She put her arms around him. He tried to be rational. What's the worst thing that can happen? I could lose everything. My job, my family, my livelihood, everything. She could hear the wild hammering of his heart. She held him till it calmed down, somewhat. She unbuttoned her shirt. They stood there, skin to skin, her brownness against his blackness, her softness against his hardness, her nut-brown breasts that wouldn't support a toothbrush against his smooth ebony chest. She smelled the river on him. His particular Paravan smell that so disgusted Baby Gujma. Amu put out her tongue and tasted it in the hollow of his throat, on the lobe of his ear. She pulled his head down toward her and kissed his mouth. A cloudy kiss. A kiss that demanded a kiss back. He kissed her back. First cautiously, then urgently. Slowly his arms came up behind her. He stroked her back, very gently. She could feel the skin on his palms, rough, calloused, sandpaper. He was careful not to hurt her. She could feel how soft she felt to him. She could feel herself through him. Her skin, the way her body existed only where he touched her, the rest of her was smoke. She felt him shudder against her. His hands were on her haunches that could support a whole array of toothbrushes, pulling her hips against his to let her know how much he wanted her. Biology designed the dance. Terror timed it, dictated the rhythm with which their bodies answered each other, as though they knew already that for each tremor of pleasure, they would pay with an equal measure of pain. As though they knew that how far they went would be measured against how far they would be taken. So they held back, tormented each other, gave of each other slowly. But that only made it worse. It only raised the stakes. It only cost them more. Because it smoothed the wrinkles, the fumble and rush of unfamiliar love, and roused them to fever pitch. Behind them, the river pulsed through the darkness, shimmering like wild silk. Yellow bamboo wept. Night's elbows rested on the water and watched them. They lay under the mangosteen tree, where only recently a grey old boat plant with boat flowers and boat fruit had been uprooted by a mobile republic. A wasp, a flag, a surprised puff, a fountain in a love in Tokyo. The scurrying, hurrying boat world was already gone. The white termites on their way to work. The white ladybirds on their way home. The white beetles burrowing away from the light. The white grasshoppers with white wood violins. The sad white music, all gone. Leaving a boat-shaped patch of bare, dry earth, cleared and ready for love. As though Estepan and Rahel had prepared the ground for them, willed this to happen. The twin midwives of Amu's dream. Amu, naked now, crouched over Velitha, her mouth on his. He drew her hair around them like a tent, like her children did when they wanted to exclude the outside world. She slid further down, introducing herself to the rest of him, his neck, his nipples, his chocolate stomach. She sipped the last of the river from the hollow of his navel. She pressed the heat of his erection against her eyelids. She tasted him, salty in her mouth. He sat up and drew her back to him. She felt his belly tighten under her, hard as a board. She felt her wetness slipping on his skin. He took her nipple in his mouth and cradled her other breast in his calloused palm. Velvet, gloved in sandpaper. At the moment that she guided him into her, she caught a passing glimpse of his youth, his youngness, the wonder in his eyes at the secret he had unearthed, and she smiled down at him as though he was her child. Once he was inside her, fear was derailed and biology took over. The cost of living climbed to unaffordable heights, though later baby Kuchma would say it was a small price to pay. Was it? Two lives? Two children's childhoods? And a history lesson for future offenders? Clouded eyes held clouded eyes in a steady gaze, and a luminous woman opened herself to a luminous man. She was as wide and deep as a river in spate. He sailed on her waters. She could feel him moving deeper and deeper into her, frantic, frenzied, asking to be let in further, further, stopped only by the shape of her, the shape of him. And when he was refused, when he had touched the deepest depths of her, with a sobbing, shuddering sigh, he drowned. She lay against him, their bodies slick with sweat. She felt his body drop away from her, his breath become more regular. She saw his eyes clear. He stroked her hair, sensing that the knot that had eased in him was still tight and quivering in her. Gently, he turned her over on her back. He wiped the sweat and grit from her with his wet cloth. He lay over her, careful not to put his weight on her. Small stones pressed into the skin of his forearms. He kissed her eyes, her ears, her breasts, her belly, her seven silver stretch marks from her twins. The line of down that led from her navel to her dark triangle that told him where she wanted him to go. The inside of her legs, where her skin was softest. Then carpenter's hands lifted her hips, and an untouchable tongue touched the innermost part of her, drank long and deep from the bowl of her. She danced for him on that boat-shaped piece of earth. She lived. He held her against him, resting his back against the mangosteen tree, while she cried and laughed at once. Then, for what seemed like an eternity but was really no more than 5 minutes, she slept leaning against him, her back against his chest. 7 years of oblivion lifted off her and flew into the shadows on weighty, quaking wings, like a dull steel peahen. And on Amu's road to age and death, a small sunny meadow appeared. Copper grass, spangled with blue butterflies. Beyond it, an abyss. Slowly the terror seeped back into him. At what he had done. At what he knew he would do again. And again. She woke to the sound of his heart knocking against his chest, as though it was searching for a way out, for that movable rib, a secret sliding folding panel. His arms were still around her. She could feel the muscles move while his hands played with a dry palm frond. Amu smiled to herself in the dark, thinking how much she loved his arms, the shape and strength of them, how safe she felt resting in them when actually it was the most dangerous place she could be. He folded his fear into a perfect rose. He held it out in the palm of his hand. She took it from him and put it in her hair. She moved closer, wanting to be within him, to touch more of him. He gathered her into the cave of his body. A breeze lifted off the river and cooled their warm bodies. It was a little cold, a little wet, a little quiet, the air. But what was there to say? An hour later, Amu disengaged herself gently.
I have to go.
He said nothing, didn't move. He watched her dress. Only one thing mattered now. They knew that it was all they could ask of each other. The only thing. Ever. They both knew that. Even later, on the 13 nights that followed this one, instinctively they stuck to the small things. The big things ever lurked inside. They knew that there was nowhere for them to go. They had nothing, no future. So they stuck to the small things. They laughed at ant bites on each other's bottoms, at clumsy caterpillars sliding off the ends of leaves, at overturned beetles that couldn't right themselves, at the pair of small fish that always sought Velitha out in the river and bit him, at a particularly devout praying mantis, at the minute spider who lived in a crack in the wall of the back veranda of the history house and camouflaged himself by covering his body with bits of rubbish, a sliver of wasp wing, part of a cobweb, dust, leaf rot, the empty thorax of a dead bee. Chaputhamburan, Velitha called him, Lord Rubbish. One night they contributed to his wardrobe a flake of garlic skin, and were deeply offended when he rejected it, along with the rest of his armor from which he emerged, disgruntled, naked, snot-colored, as though he deplored their taste in clothes. For a few days he remained in this suicidal state of disdainful undress. The rejected shell of garbage stayed standing, like an outmoded worldview, an antiquated philosophy. Then it crumbled. Gradually, Chaputhamburan acquired a new ensemble. Without admitting it to each other or themselves, they linked their fates, their futures, their love, their madness, their hope, their infinite joy, to his. They checked on him every night, with growing panic as time went by, to see if he had survived the day. They fretted over his frailty, his smallness, the adequacy of his camouflage, his seemingly self-destructive pride. They grew to love his eclectic taste, his shambling dignity. They chose him because they knew that they had to put their faith in fragility, stick to smallness. Each time they parted, they extracted only one small promise from each other. Tomorrow? Tomorrow. They knew that things could change in a day. They were right about that. They were wrong about Chaputhamburan, though. He outlived Velitha. He fathered future generations. He died of natural causes. That first night, on the day that Sophie Moll came, Velitha watched his lover dress. When she was ready, she squatted facing him. She touched him lightly with her fingers and left a trail of goosebumps on his skin, like flat chalk on a blackboard, like breeze in a paddy field, like jet streaks in a blue church sky. He took her face in his hands and drew it towards his. He closed his eyes and smelled her skin. Amu laughed. Yes, Margaret, she thought. We do it to each other, too. She kissed his closed eyes and stood up. Velitha, with his back against the mangosteen tree, watched her walk away. She had a dry rose in her hair. She turned to say it once again. Nale. Tomorrow. This concludes the reading of The God of Small Things by Arundhati Roy. Copyright 1997 by Arundhati Roy. This book was read by Sneha Martin. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Rome Agency, in association with David Godwin Associates Limited, and was produced in 2017 by Blackstone Audio Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-SAY-BOOK. 729
2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.